Hi, I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, a Christian who is grateful to be in recovery as an adult child of a dysfunctional family, and my name is Eloise.
Hi.
I'm a second-generation American, the second of five children. My grandparents were godly Swedish and Irish immigrants. The carefully guarded family secret was that Mom's mom had been born out of wedlock, and Dad was expected prior to his parents' marriage. My mother and father were conflicted. They were obedient children with old world values, and they were raising me, a willful child. Obsessive compulsion and rage in my family were very familiar. I'm told that I was a difficult child. I was born an insomniac, a Houdini of crib and locked doors before the age of two. At six, I ran into the path of an oncoming car and spent the next 3 days in a coma. I did my best to throw myself against the confines of my universe, testing to see how far I could push limits. My first home was a large Victorian house in Titusville, Pennsylvania. My very earliest memory at the age of 2.5 is sitting in a very dark space eating a chocolate chip cookie. I'm buried in a coat closet. In the background, voices are raised and angry. My mother is mad because I have stolen a cookie. My father is trying to calm her down, but all I hear is that I am a thief. When I was four, Mom insisted that we move into a new home with a finished bathroom so that she could bathe her third baby, my little brother Ernie, in warmth. And somehow I had deduced that I was less important. We moved to a country home in Titusville, one of two model homes. Intended to be a medium-sized development, the project stopped after these two homes were completed, and we had acre upon acre of undeveloped fields and woods to roam in. My neighbor Gary became my very first best friend. And oh, the freedom of being out of the house and away from family offered. I was easily ignored, and I stayed out of the line of fire. When I was five, child number four, Mark, another brother, was born, and Santa Claus came to town that year. I actually have the newspaper proof of my father lifting me up so I can see him. And it is very dear to me because it proves to me that at least once in my life, my father held me. My dad fell ill and had to change professions. He could no longer teach math and science. The fumes from the lab were too hazardous. We had to move to Breckenridge, Pennsylvania. So at the age of six, I waved goodbye to my best friend. We were not long in Breckenridge when Dad was transferred to Dunkirk, New York. For several months, Mom was left behind with four children, ages 1 to 12. Mom was ill-equipped to act as a single parent. Dealing with children, sending each other between the basement and the second story via a dumb waiter and a laundry chute were a little bit too much for her to handle. Dad purchased a cottage in Fredonia, New York, and once again we moved, and I vowed never to have another friend. My new front yard was Lake Erie. There were miles of beach to roam, Lake Erie State Park just 2 miles to the west, Van Buren just a bike ride through the woods, and this was real freedom. But taking away that freedom became my mother's best punishment. She would point to the sofa and command, "Go and sit on the couch and act like a lady." And stay there until I tell you you can get up. My mother accused me of being sexually active long before I knew what she was talking about. I was 8 when she reported incorrectly an event to my father. Dad took off his belt in front of my mom and my younger brothers. He beat me. I didn't have the courage to tell my dad that Mom was wrong. I couldn't call her a liar. I wanted to live. My father raged, and I learned that truth really doesn't matter. The next day, as I was bruised from armpit to knees, my mother ridiculed my dad for doing exactly what she had set him up to do. And as a child, I would never trust my mom again. Dad's rage stopped being physical after that. He never laid a hand on me again. But from that point on, when his anger would rise, my father would turn and walk away. And I started to view God as a reflection of my father, cold, angry, and distant. My folks joined the Baptist Church, which became my parents' reason not to let me go to movies, school plays, football, basketball, baseball games, play board games, or games with cards or dice. My mother didn't approve of any friend that was different from us, so I had no friends. I was a prisoner in my own home. I remember giving my life to Christ when I was 8. We sat in church and sang, "Are you able to remember when a thief lifts up his eyes that his pardoned soul is worthy of a place in paradise?" If Jesus loved a thief, then maybe God would someday too. I was only allowed to go to church camp if I saved the tuition. When I returned, I often found that my mom had had my bedroom wall papered or painted, switching bedroom furniture as she pleased. Once when I tried to rearrange my bedroom, she told me that I wasn't allowed to. Pleading that it was my bedroom, I was informed in no uncertain terms that it was not my bedroom, that the house belonged to my mom and dad, that it was not my furniture, that all the furniture in the house belonged to my mom and dad. In fact, she explained, there was nothing at all in the house that belonged to me. I was stripped of any sense of ownership, of self, of independence, and at age 11, I determined to leave my mother's house and find a place of my own as soon as possible. I cannot remember one conversation with my mother. On occasion, when I would approach her and ask if she would talk to me, the reply was always not now. I'm listening to the Radio Bible Hour, or Miracles and Melodies, or Christian Crusade, or Through the Bible, or she was dusting, cleaning, vacuuming. There never was now. At the age of 13 and a half, I finally had a sister. On the day of her birth, we were told my dad was dying. Though he never drank, he had cirrhosis of the liver, and he was given 5 years, living 8. I was given my sister and my brothers to tend while Mom cared for her husband. We were not permitted to go anywhere overnight, nor to have anyone come to the house. I was isolated. Mom's frustration and stress level ran high and her temper short. She had lived for my father. She was ill-equipped to be left a widow, let alone one with children. Mom dictated my every minute, and I became her servant. I graduated high school and expressed my intent to take a summer job, only to be informed that my father had enrolled me in the local university and had declared my major. What I wanted did not matter. I had no voice. I was not allowed to say no. There were no boundaries. I started to date, and I want to tell you that at 18, I was desperate for attention. My boyfriend drank, and I ended up frequenting bars with him on weekends. New York, it was legal then. I started to drink pretty heavily, smoked pot. A pregnancy was aborted. We talked about marriage, but sex was my way of assuring that I had physical attention. After graduating college, my boyfriend packed up and left me behind. He abandoned the relationship without warning. Then my father passed away. At a party, an acquaintance drugged my drink. I woke in a strange bed alone, knowing that I had been raped, and not one friend there had lifted a finger to stop it. I aborted that pregnancy, refusing an opportunity to be condemned in my family court. I was humiliated, I was ashamed, and I was afraid. I packed and I ran to California, and I discovered that God has really long legs, because there he ushered me into a church that taught faith and mercy, not law. The evening pastor wore jeans and sandals and had long hair. In body life, for the first time, I felt as if maybe I fit in. And there I met my first husband, Brian. He was a guy with a zany sense of humor. He was creative, musical, poetic, and we were married 9 months later. We moved to New York to help out my mom, and together we led the youth group at the Baptist church that I had attended as a child. He on guitar, I teaching in Proverbs. No one else wanted the job. We were asked to meet with a pastor one afternoon. Frank explained to us that the senior elder had determined that we could not lead the youth group if we weren't members of the church. I led him to the back of the assembly hall where a plaque hung stating that to become a member you could not play cards, go to movies, dance, listen to rock and roll, the list went on. And handing my Bible to Frank, I asked him to show me where any of this was stated. Brian and I stepped down. Frank resigned. When did faith in Christ stop being enough? I was hurt, I was confused, and I was angry. And on top of that, my brother Mark was killed in a car accident. Then after 2 years of marriage, the real Brian showed up. He refused to work, refused to make house payments, went back on all the promises he had made to my mom and to me. I felt a fool, I felt betrayed, and I had married a liar. We returned to California. A friend invited me to interview with National Semiconductor for a position in their customer service department. This proved to be the most wonderful, fulfilling job that I have ever had. I was invited to join a team to research, design, and implement a worldwide order processing system, traveling to Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, Australia, Germany. The walls of my universe were expanded beyond my dreams. And during that time, Brian started drinking pretty heavily, smoking pot, I was not permitted to set foot in the room that he claimed as his study. I wasn't permitted to see the checking of the savings books. He hid the fact that he was spending our savings to justify not working. He had a temper, screaming in rage when things weren't going his way, arguing tangentially, throwing objects against the room, into a wall, to accentuate his rage. And then after 13 years of marriage, I filed for divorce, waiting through 2 more years of legal bantering for Brian to see the light, mend his ways, and giving up, I packed up my VW Beetle, and I ran, heading down to Cabo San Lucas. There, I met Lucky Dog, Dennis's nickname. As a recovering alcoholic, he had moved to the Baja to regain sanity. For months, Dennis and I spent time together fishing, swimming, walking the beach, cooking dinners, checking out the town. Dennis proposed to me. We had sold real estate together, and I loved being a resort tour guide. We worked well as a team. We married and bought a house. Mornings, I would rise, coffee in hand, and watch the world awaken at my feet, the sun rising over the Sea of Cortez. I had never felt so at peace, but by now I had left God in the dust. Then came Desert Storm, drying up tourism investment. We went through all of our money just to stay afloat. Dennis took a job in Oregon. I hawked my jewelry, Martin guitar, and rented a house in Kaiser. We moved into a 3-bedroom, 1-bath home with 2 cats, 2 dogs, 3 webbed beach chairs, a Coleman camp table, and we slept on 2 foam sheets in a doubled sleeping bag. We had very little, we were pretty broke, but we were happy. Within a few months, we were joined by Dennis's 14-year-old daughter and his 20-year-old son, and within the year, my brother Ernie had moved in as well. And during that chaotic time, my husband lost all interest in me. For the next 18 years, he pushed me away. I felt unloved, alone, confused, and lost. I gained weight to build a protective wall. Dennis's mom, Gladys, had failing health, so we moved to Sacramento in order to be close to family. Soon after, I discovered that during his post-knee surgery boredom, my husband had been indulging in the wide web of porn. I felt dirty, used, betrayed, and heartbroken. I would pray, Lord, please bring Dennis to a knowledge of you. Please save him, whatever it takes. But I did not step up to the plate to be a witness to him. By now, I was deeply steeped in codependency. As I became a necessary fixture in Gladys's life, the national economy tanked. We spent savings and retirement funds to keep above water. Gladys passed away, our house was sold on short sale, and once again financially we had lost nearly everything. We returned to Oregon and moved into a manufactured home. In November 2010, I was diagnosed as needing a triple bypass surgery. I went under on December 20th, and I have never experienced such misery. For the next 3 days, I really wished that I had not survived the surgery. On June 5th, my email address book was hacked. Earthlink informed me that I had to change my password through my husband's profile. For the prior 18 months, monies had not been making it home, as were evidenced by the paychecks. So while in Earthlink, I went to investigate whether I could find a hint in his email of where he may have been squirreling away cash, just as his mother had always done. The wall of the shockwave robbed me of my breath as I opened the proof of his adultery. I walked onto the porch and I stared until breathing resumed, and I implored of heaven, "What are you doing?" Betrayed and angry, I did what I know best how to do. With a heart as cold as steel, I turned and I packed and I ran, leaving behind proof of discovery and a letter spelling out the release from my marriage vows. God, however, has really long arms. 2 years prior, my friend Gina had planned a 3-week vacation for her family in Hawaii. Now, as I drove south, she called in panic. Her house sitter had backed out. And I was given 3 weeks of solitude on a ranch outside of Sacramento. God, me, my Bible, and my family 20 minutes away. God and I wrestled during that time. We argued, he urging me not to seek vengeance, me crying out with David, "Lord, you have laid siege of me." every face-to-face reading, every radio song, every Sunday sermon ministered to me. And I shook my fists at heaven and I begged for understanding, but I never shed one tear. Driving to my sister's home one day, I pulled to the side of the road and I listened as Cutlass sang, "Hope that doesn't ever end. Broken hearts become brand new. That's what faith can do." And at the foot of the cross, acknowledging the depth of God's love and forgiveness for me, this thief, this murderer, realized that she had no right not to extend grace to anyone. Though Dennis had tried calling me several times, I had refused to answer. When I answered the next phone call, I heard what sounded like a repentant man. He related to me that he had called Good Shepherd, our home church, and a woman there had put him in touch with a mentor with whom he had met. He was involved in a support group, and I hung up wondering if I cared. Immediately, I dialed Good Shepherd, and I got that woman on the phone, and I raged. What about me? What about those of us who have been hurt? What is there for us? What is there for me? And to my utter amazement, she lovingly encouraged me to return home and try to forgive. Come to celebrate recovery. It's on Friday night. I'll meet you there so that you don't have to be alone. I packed and I headed for home. And in July, I came. And Mary met me. And she sat with me. And I listened. And I attended the 101 class, all the while thinking, why am I here? I'm not the one who belongs here. But I came back. And I listened, and I attended the open share group, and I listened over top of voices screaming inside of me, I'm not the one who belongs here. But I came back. And I listened, and I attended the open share group, and I listened as women told my life story with words from their own. And I realized that I was broken. And being broken, I became teachable. Mary, my hound dog of heaven, lovingly encouraged me to speak with a counselor who had walked my path. And in August, I joined six women in a 9-month sojourn through the valley of spousal sexual addiction. But was Mary done with me yet? No. She encouraged me to enter the 12-step program that was just about to start, and in September I did. Going through the 12-step program, the layers of armor that I had built around my heart were peeled off one by one. I learned to forgive genealogically inherited familial dysfunction, the effect of abandonment on every branch of my family tree. I was given tools with which to live a godly life and the courage to use them. The realization that it was not my job to fix my mom, but to rather to love her. And I found that I have not been running from. I have been running to. A forever family where I am loved and accepted for who I am, who God created me to be. No matter what I've done, no matter where I've been, no judgment, no condemnation, but rather acceptance and encouragement. I have been running to you. I belong here. The road has been rough, and I have hated the path. Even so, I wouldn't trade one second of my journey for the gift that the Lord has given me. In September 2011, Dennis gave his life to the Lord, and now I have a husband and a marriage and a brother and a friend. Thanksgiving Day this year, my mother told me that she was thankful for me. And honestly and joyfully, I expressed my thankfulness for her. It has taken 62 years, but we now have a now. If it were not for a Mary in my life, I wouldn't be here. If it were not for my sponsor, my open share 12-step and life's healing choice small group leaders, my accountability partners, and a list of others whom I have come to love and respect, I would not be here. Some time ago, I found myself wondering, where do I go from here? What lies beyond celebrate recovery? As I walked through the family room with the TV on, I heard the speaker say, there is season for everything. You cannot stay in recovery forever. Stopping dead in my tracks, I asked of heaven, Lord, what do you mean you can't stay in recovery? The Lord replayed a memory from decades before when Eloise, determined to conquer her greatest fear, height, decided to try rock climbing. Showing up at the introductory class, I stood at the base of the cliff that I was about to climb and wondering, why am I here? Before I could run away, the guide showed up at my side. While wrangling me into a harness, they explained that my instructor would be along shortly, and they were gone. Up strolled a seasoned climber who introduced himself. Hi, I'm Tom. I watched as Tom, seeking foothold and fingerhold, scaled the cliff freehand. Securing his rope around an immovable object and placing himself between two sides of the rope, he lowered the free end to me and, signaling that he was ready to help me climb, called out, Tom is on belay. The guides reappeared. They wove the rope in and out of the harness grommets while giving me instructions, and they were gone. And I called out, belay up, may I climb now? Signaling the okay, Tom responded, belay away, and I did my best to imitate what I had seen him do, toe hold and finger hold, while Tom, hand over hand, let down the free end of the rope for the next climber, while expertly taking up the slack on the end attached to me. If I slipped, I would not fall far, and I made it to the top. Now, after 3.5 years of celebrating recovery, counseling, 2 12-step programs, I'm not about to say I've had a mountaintop experience. No, from where I stand, I see mountains I have yet to climb. Relational hurts, adult children of dysfunctional family, codependency, food issues, and just maybe someday the aftermath of traumatic stress. But I know that at each, I will find experienced and seasoned guides and climbers who have gone before me, assuring me that if I slip, I will not have to fall far. My sobriety solution in part reads, progressing from hurting to healing to helping. And I get it. You don't stay in recovery. I am a sponsor. I'm an accountability partner. I'm an open share leader for hurts, habits, and hangups. I'm a TEAM member, a trainer in training. And with my back braced against the tree, and my feet planted firmly on the rock, Eloise is on belay. Thank you for letting me share.